Bonnie Connie, everyone. This is Professor Amin Ra, Professor Emeritus, California State University of Long Beach, a retired professor from Compton Community College, where I taught African American history, psychology, and ethnic studies, and was a former director of Transfer Center, counselor, and also a faculty member. Also joining us will be historian Joe Hembrick, longtime educator from the Compton Unified in Linwood, and a football coach, as well as an administrator and teacher for both of those districts. And at the same time, he's a historian of African-American history and life, going all the way back to the beginnings, his deep research. First of all, we want to thank all of you that will be viewing this program, and we welcome those that will be joining us later. Tonight, we have a very special guest. In celebration of our year, first year completed, a podcast, we have one of the most dynamic and innovative presenters tonight. I've known him for a long time, and we have traveled in many same circles. But above all, his resume and his contribution to the forward flow of our liberation as Black people is monumentous. And his contribution to making Compton a more safer and more productive and conscious city is legendary in the city, as he worked to get a name of a Black president on one of our streets, Obama. And he's also worked with many of the youth in the community, but he's well known throughout, from seniors all the way to young people, for his activism. Marvin Ayatollah, or Ayatollah Muhammad, graduated from the University of Islam in 1969. Doctrine University. He got a doctorate from the University of San Quentin in political reasoning and strategies. Che Guevara, Fidel Castro, Ho Chi Minh, Mao Zedong, Karl Marx, and Dr. Maulana Karenga, as well as in 1971, created the first youth council and USC Teacher Corps in Compton's Model Cities Program, Compton Service Center, Youth Gang Outreach, 1992 Revolts, spearheaded talks with Garth Brooks, having him donate $1 million to Compton Youth Education Town for at-risk gang members and troubled youth. In 2014, the City of Compton, Dr. Dre Day, Compton's first Black billionaire, joined June 19th, Dr. Dre Day, City of Compton, and in 2015, Stop the Violence, Increase the Peace, Columbus, Ohio, with Sean Stevenson, King Tone, Latin Kings of New York, Melvin Farmer, 83rd Street, 83rd Gangster Crips, and formulated what is now a national network called Credible Messengers, Turning Around Youth Mindset. Wow, that's a lot, but he does a lot. I mean, he has enormous energy. So, brother Ayatollah, would you go ahead and tell us anything else you want to add to your resume, and then start discussing some of the issues that you think address the various projects you've been working on. Go ahead. Brother. Brother.
Yes, sir. Yes. Thank you so much, Professor Raw. And it's a pleasure and an honor to that you have me as a guest on your elated program. And you've been very instrumental in a lot of my works from day one, you know, having the consciousness to arrive and try to make our city a better place despite all the controversy and the stuff that goes on. I've been in since day one from Nightmare on Elm Street. Can you hear me? Your sound is off.
No, go ahead, Brother Marvin. Because you keep freezing.
Can you
too.
Hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. But I don't see you talking. Your picture is froze.
Okay. I don't know what that is. Let me see.
But you can just go ahead and talk. We can hear you. There you are. You're moving now. You froze again. All right.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear us?
Oh yeah, you're breaking up. I was saying that I grew up in Compton. I was raised in Compton on Elm Street, Nightmare on Elm Street. We ran Freddy Krueger out of our neighborhood. And we've always had a thirst for betterment. And where I grew up, it was, you know, we all had one goal into making our lives better. Some of us took another road in order to what we do. But we've come into a situation now where I'm at this part of my life of dealing with Black youth. And I'm unapologetically striving for the salvation of Black youth in America. Not that I'm putting anybody else down, but we make ourselves so inclusive with every other race. We try to befriend Mexicans. We try to befriend the Orientals, the Asians. But when they get their clarification and the declaration on their race, they don't make us included. They do things without us. But the Black man is always trying to bring the other races into our fold, and they contaminate it. You can look at the George Foreman Black Lives Matter. In Black Lives Matter, everybody profited from Black Lives Matter but Blacks. So we're the only race of people that criticize our young. You don't hear Mexicans down in Mexican children. You don't hear Asians down. We're our Black people, older Black people, always criticize. Like, we don't understand where they are. But we were just like them when we grew up. It was another dispensation. But we grew up on Beauty's Only Skin Deep. It's Growing, and did some atrocious things in America. And these Black kids now, we done left them to America. Now they're playing video games and become killers at 3 and 4 years old. San Andreas Fault, Call to Duty. These young Black boys are learning to kill. By the time they get 16, it's just a matter of a function. So we're programming our children, and we as credible messengers go into facilities and go into neighborhoods and try to reprogram the thinking of our young Black individuals.
Okay. Talk a little bit about those gang troops you're trying to work with, and those Stop the Violence, Increase the Peace programs that you worked with.
Yes, and that was the downfall of the 92 gang truce, because to have a truce, it doesn't mean that you come and party with anybody. It don't mean you go and drink because you got bloodshed. Somebody lost somebody in their neighborhood and they don't feel good about it. Now you invade their neighborhood and you start. So that's why the gang truce didn't work, because nobody told us about the respection of boundaries. When you have a truce, don't mean that you can go. And only people that go into your area is people that invaded you. So we have a misconception of what our truces are supposed to be about and how Black people deal with each other. And we always let somebody else not like us coordinate what our lives are about. After the gang truce, they had the guy, I can't think of his name, but he was over the guy that did the budgeting for the 1984 Olympics, Ruben Rubikoff, I believe his name was. So this great white father coming in, doling out monies to gang members. Now everybody wants to get the biggest part, so everything fails. So every truce that we start, we are always invaded by the CIA, COINTELPRO. Now they didn't got past COINTELPRO, they got Operation Weed and Seed. And Operation Weed and Seed started in 1983, where they went and got all the original gang members out, took them to prison and had them killed. And replaced them with agents. So now you got most of these guys that are gang members or activities, they're working for the feds. They talk about the grid program and they take about all of these programs that these dudes go back every month and debrief with white America on the actions that's going on in the community.
So when you were working with the brothers that's incarcerated, and you speak constantly at these various institutions, what is there any progress? Is there anything that you have been able to get through to some of the brothers that you have spoken to?
Well, I mean, you look at what do we gain as progress? I go into, when I talk to youngsters, I try to redirect their thinking. Rehabilitation is taking somebody out of one situation and putting them in another. When you have a man in prison and he's living in his cell in prison and making it, and then you bring him back to the streets to his same neighborhood with nothing, that's not rehabilitation, that's recidivism. So in redirecting, I try to change people's thinking of who they are and what they can be right in their own environment. You ain't got to run out of Compton to be successful. You can look at that, the people that done run to Temecula, then run to Simi Valley. Now they out there stuck by themselves, you know, leaving the best part of the land. So we have to concentrate on, because, I mean, you got Professor Raw, you've got almost 40 years right now of kids at 40 years old didn't have any direction. When I grew up, Black men controlled my way of thinking. I looked up to Black men. Now Black grown men look up to 22-year-old kids. They try to be 20 instead of being the man that they are. Or then you have the other ones that are cowards. They don't come out. Oh, I can't talk to these kids. It's not a kid in the world you should be scared of as a Black man.
So when you, how does law enforcement, you've had a lot of experience with the law enforcement in Compton, when they were Compton PD and with sheriffs and things. I remember Tony Muhammad was working with the chief of police of LA. What is the relationship and what do you see? Especially when they had that that Los Angeles, you know, the assassination of Tupac and Biggie, possible law enforcement involvement, as well as there was a big scandal in LAPD. They were dealing drugs and they arrested a bunch of people. But you had a lot of information concerning law enforcement and their contribution to the problems that we're having in the community, and them framing people and doing things. So share some of those experiences.
Well, I mean, the Compton Police Department at one time was a great police department, because everybody that was in Compton Police Department, when Huey, Percy Paradon, Webb, Bunton, all of them lived in the community. So you knew where their mother's house was. You knew them. They grew up, you know. Huey been a police all his life. He was a safety at Tibby. He was a safety at Enterprise. He been in the police business all his life. You know what I'm saying? So when he got into the force, he was somebody that we knew. So at when the new guard of police came in 76, 77, 78, when Reggie Wright Jr., Reggie Wright, Eric Paradon, they came in with another mindset. And then they start separating themselves as police. These is good boys that never been in trouble. All of a sudden, they became gang members. You know what I'm saying? So you had one side that became a Crip. The other side became a Piru. And so they pushing lines. The police is pushing lines. You dig what I'm saying? So now they found out it was more profitable to align with dope dealers and take, why do I have to arrest you? I can take all your dope and redistribute it somewhere else. So it became a lucrative business for the entire California Police Department. And then with the gang violence that they precipitated, because 90% of the shootings that came on in the 80s and the 90s were done, my belief is, by the police. Because you can't have this kid that ain't never took a shot, never practiced shooting, go by at 40 miles an hour and shoot and kill five people, shooting them in the head. And then when he shoot at the police, he can't even shoot them in the leg. A killer is a killer. You don't discriminate when you shoot. You know what I'm saying? So as long as it was profiting to the police department, now you see gang violence done went down, because now they done made enough money off of it. So you don't hear about it in the paper every day. I was just telling one of my friends the other day, I'm going to Compton court with the Suge Knight trial. This is a civil suit against Terry Carter's family is suing Suge, trying to get blood out of a turnip. But I remember you would go in Compton court, you'd have to wait around the corner, around the line to get into the courthouse. Now you can just walk straight into the courthouse, right? Mm-hmm. So they ain't already got the profit and suck blacks dry. So it's no big thing. It was a time your child would go to juvenile hall. Now they closed down East Lake Juvenile Hall. They closed down Selmar. Now they tell you haven't been allowed to take care of your child for the last 20 years. Now the police is telling you handle it. When your child is out of control, you used to just say, man, I can't handle them. You understand me? Mm-hmm. And they would take you to jail, and you do a year or 2 years for incorrigible. Mm-hmm. Now they tell you, we don't want your child in jail. Unless they didn't commit a murder, we don't want them. You got to be at home with them. So you have these children that are displaced, and it's all organized by the law enforcement agencies that are around. Compton Police, it got terminated because the same police was always doing the same thing. The difference between the sheriff here in Compton and the Compton Police Department, a sheriff can't stay on his beat no longer than 18 months. So you don't have the same dude bothering you every day for years and years and years. Don't make us no better, but you have a different rotation of police coming into you. So it makes it a bigger business. Right now, you don't see no black sheriffs. Where are all the black? Every sheriff you see is a Mexican. Mm-hmm. So you think they don't side with Mexicans? Everybody's against us and us against us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, but they say that a lot of the instigations and conflicts is from people shot callers from the institutions, like brothers that's in prison, still calling the shots on the street. And that's what the police say. But, you know, you have that experience of working with brothers that's been locked down.
That used to happen in the 60s and the 70s when the BGF, when Doc Holliday then was running the BGF, when George was running, it was through word of mouth. Ain't nobody listening to no man or no gang member listening to some man. How you gonna call a shot on me when you can't even stand up and tell a white man tell you to stand up? What kind of shot call? How are you going to give me orders? And you went to prison at 17 or 18 years old for a murder for free. And now you didn't become in prison and you didn't become such a pseudo intellectual. You're going to tell me what to do on the street. That's a myth that the police is trying to put in people's head. Ain't nobody listening to nobody in prison. Mm-hmm. They don't listen to you on the street. I'm one of the oldest dudes around here. If these youngsters don't want to listen to what I say, man, the hell with Marv. I ain't listen to Ayatollah. Mm-hmm. We have a mindset of children right now that if they don't think that you will hurt them badly, they will test you. They will test you because they haven't had any structure in 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I got one more question that I'm going to let other people ask you questions. But, you know, you've done a lot to help a lot of young people, starting security programs and working with various city officials. And you was trying to get a movement to name a street in Compton behind a black hero or heroine. How's that coming and what's going on with that movement?
Well, like you said before, I was in a youth authority, and I came out of youth authority and start working with Huey Taylor, Sergeant Bunton him at the service center to bring in youth gangs. And then I went over to Model Cities and we started the first youth council. And I took influential brothers up out of Centennial Compton High School and Dominguez and showed them how the workings of the government were. And in the workings of the government, you know, my youth council members was Paul Richardson, Lawrence Adams, you know, Walter Tucker, Omar Bradley. These dudes and went on to do great things because it was lucrative for them to see how government ran. You feel what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So now you have a thing that's going on. Now we have city government. Do you realize we were the first black city west of the Mississippi in 1970? The first black-run city west of the Mississippi. We've had at least 14 black mayors and city managers and we don't have one street named after a black man. A black. Well, that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. How did we sleep on that so long? And now they're sitting there like, oh, they can't make President Barack Obama drive, or you done everything else that didn't amount to nothing. But we have one street in Compton that's named after a black man, and the white mayor made that, and the street that Huey Taylor grew up on was called Alabama. And the mayor in 1964 said it was a racial connotation after Mega Everest got killed. And he named the street Mega Everest. All you know is the street's name is Everest. And it's on Poplar and Poplar right next to Tejada, the street Everest. It was named after Mega Everest. But if you ain't been here all your life, you don't even know that, huh?
Mm-hmm. You're right. But your effort to try to get Obama Street or any black hero name, is it getting any traction?
Well, yeah. What I'm trying to do is incite the unknown class, which y'all call gang members, and try to get them to do the signatures, because I believe if you show these youngsters that they can accomplish one thing, mm-hmm. and that's the problem with our young blacks, they feel so helpless that mm-hmm. they don't even want to try. Oh, ain't no use in doing that. It ain't going to work. They have such a defeatist attitude. That, well, man, that ain't gonna never work. Fuck that, bro. I'm not doing that. Oh, they ain't gonna change nothing. As long as you keep that mindset, you'll never be successful. So I'm trying to agitate enough of their spirits for them to just sign their names and us get 3,000 signatures and push up on Emma Sharif and the rest of these coons that don't do nothing, that sit up and pretend and not do anything for the community, you know?
Okay. Good. All right, Brother Mashinda, do you have any questions for Ayatollah? Are you there, Mashinda? Yes.
Good evening, Ayatollah.
Yes, sir.
How you doing? I just want to thank you for all your service, what you're doing, what you've been doing. You know, just listening to you, not only is it, you know, I'm in agreement with just about everything you're saying in terms of, you know, reflecting the experiences and what I've witnessed, you know, in my experiences. And I just want to, you know, I just want to thank you. I'm listening to your experience tonight. What I want to say is, so the state of the gang, you know, situation, just as far as from your standpoint, you know, like Crips and Bloods, or the relationship between Hispanic gangs and the Black gangs, speaking relatively in Compton, you know, what is the status? What is the status? You know, I heard you said the courthouses are, you know, there's not any long lines in the court, you know, court lines and things like that. So as far as gang violence and sets, you know, like different sets in different neighborhoods, you know, I know a lot of demographics have changed. So what's the, you know, the brothers that you're concentrating on are, you know, is it a lot of brothers that are still congregating and gang banging, or where is that at right now?
Right now we have such a sickness and a cancer in Compton right now. Pyrus and Crips don't even fight anymore. You got Pyrus killing Pyrus and Crips killing Crips. Black on black murder and homicide and robbery. And you have the Mexican gangs are running over the taco flats. They done went into treetops and almost took over their whole neighborhood, 151 neighborhood, Compton Barrio Thresi. So the Mexican gangs are eating us up. They just had an incident. All the lowriders was going to over on Alameda and Peck, and they lowride every Sunday. And I was out of town, and I came back, and all the blacks, and they went up to the DMV. And I was out in, they had a motorcycle function yesterday in Gonzales Park. And one of the guys out of the car club, he was talking about, I'm asking where the Funday Sunday going to be. He said, man, they're supposed to be up at DMV. Finds out that some Mexicans rolled up on the brothers over on Alameda, the Largos, and pulled guns on, like, what you niggas doing over here in our neighborhood? And that's taking us back to the 50s. You know what I'm saying? And you got 300 dudes out there, and you got four Mexicans run you off of Alameda? We'll defend everything but ourselves. It's easy for me to kill you or do something to you, but we don't do it to nobody else. It's sad. A brother called me Friday night. The Mexicans was on Central and Rosecrans doing burnouts. Brother called me 11 o'clock at night, Nah from Westside, one of the OGs, like, man, these dudes out here in front of Tams tearing stuff up. I said, well, he said, man, I need to go out there with my AK and start letting off something. I said, well, why would you do it, Nah? One side of the street is Campanella Park. The other side of the street is neighborhood. The other side of the street is Westside Pyru. The other side of the street is 134 Pyrus. Where's all these gang members that's holding their nuts all day long? How ain't nobody can come in my hood. Now you got 300 Mexicans. You can't see a black gang member nowhere. So our mindset can become so closet. Everybody's gang banging right now, brother, is on the internet. Everybody internet gang banging.
All right. Brother Hendrick, you have any questions? This principal Hembrick, a historian Hembrick, I think he was a administrator when your son was in school. Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, brother. I know the brother. I used to be the football coach at the 10.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I spoke at Ra's Saturday thing we used to have back in the day over at the little used to be library, and I just recently saw you at the bank.
Right, right.
I don't know if you can see me, if you can see me clearly, but also I want to.
Yes, sir. I remember you. Yeah, I remember you from the team.
Okay, I want to offer my condolences to you. I think it was your niece who ended up getting killed a few months back, and I saw it.
Yes,
on
the sir.
Yeah, and I saw you too. I said, I know that, and I knew the sister too. So, you know, I was at the 10 a long time, man.
Yes, sir.
I tried a lot of the stuff. I used to have people straight out. You know, I used to get all the gang. Well, I got a tenant, my sister. Hold on, so I said, hey, look, I'm on the radio. I'm home. Come on, bring it to me. Bye. Excuse me for that. I got a tenant that's trying to pay rent. I can't miss that. But anyway, tried a lot of things at the 10, and I experienced a lot of stuff you talked about. Crips killing Crips, blood killing bloods, you know, the Latino takeover and all of that with the Marcos and all of them. I remember it was Cinco de Mayo at Centennial, getting ready to come up. And they told all the brothers, if you come to school, we're gonna whoop your ass. So the next day, I'm out there with my PE class on the blacktop, and a brother shows up. Ain't no brothers at school. And he said, man, where everybody at? I said, hey, they didn't come. Hey, them punk,
you know, ain't that something? Right.
And all of that. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And I was trying to mend the relationship. I don't know if you looked on the 40s roll at the 10 with that mural that I designed with the two pyramids there. If you haven't seen it, you need to go see it.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Brother Roscani sees it all the time. But anyway, chewed up a lot of the same turf you're talking about. We crossed paths. I tried for 30-some years, man. I was just, you know, I couldn't figure out what to do. I tried all kind of stuff while I was there. I was witnessing that rat pack and stuff that was going on, which I thought that was some old punk stuff right there, and I used to check them on that. But, you know, it's a tough battle trying to work on their minds. But once I was in the classroom teaching that history class, I was getting to a lot of them, you know, and I kind of fought myself for not staying in there longer, coming out being an administrator, trying to get, you know, paid instead of staying in the classroom so I could turn out a lot more soldiers than I did. But appreciating all that you're saying. And matter of fact, I'm good buddies with the Wynn brothers. You know, Big Mac and his little brother,
right.
Shrine. Yeah. Matter of fact, Roscani grew up with them. But anyway, been in Compton since 65. I left Linwood to come to Centennial to try to make a difference. Actually, took a pay cut to do it. And I really enjoyed my experiences there, as rough as some of the stuff was. I got in the business to help our people, not other folks. So that's the reason
that's
I did.
That's right.
And appreciate you and, you know, what you're saying and what you're doing. And I'm going to back on off and let you share some more information. But I was teaching my kids about the King Alfred plan and all that stuff back at Centennial when I was a classroom teacher. And I was just up there the other day, and the morale is ridiculous.
Right.
Man,
well, it's a different dispensation, and people don't have teachers come in now. They don't have the love and the vigor for teaching. It's just a job.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And then you get some teachers that want to be a pal to a child. You can't be their friend. I tell my son told me one day that, oh, Dad, you did something when you was. I said, well, how did you know? Me and you didn't grow up together. I just met you 20 years ago. I had sex with your mother. You was a plus one, bro. We ain't cool like that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's a stability we have to maintain with our children, and we let it get away. in prison, bro. The Mexican mafia, they tell all their youngsters, you don't deal with Mayates on this, you don't do this. But young blacks, even here on the streets, we don't have anybody to instruct these kids. Nobody give them true instructions.
Mm-hmm. All right. Joe had to leave. Rusty?
You guys able to hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I met Marv back when his son was in my class. And what I admire, he was there on a consistent basis, making sure that his son was doing what he was supposed to do. I mean, how better can you get it, you know? Yeah. We need parents like that that's gonna be there for their children. And I mean, it's more than just the parents when it comes to the school. And that's what's missing. I can see it because I'm right there. There's no structure to bring together the parents, the staff, all of our administrators' focus is just on testing, district testing, and the CASP. That's all they focus on. They don't focus on the needs of the kids, be it Hispanic or black. But I saw where brother came, and he was supporting his child as much as he could. And I appreciate that. We need more brothers like Kensi. We need them, you know. So I just appreciate the brother, and I'm glad you're here giving us this information. And I'm just going to sit back and listen. I'm on the road coming from Sacramento.
Yes, sir.
Picking up my daughter. But I'm enjoying it.
So, yes, sir. Mom, under the auspices of your training, and, you know, because, you know, you're a street warrior and you put in work. And, you know, I remember back in the 60s, you had Bob Simmons, Boys Home, and Miss Shaw had Boys Home on Pine and Santa Fe. I was a product of that. Fred Horn, they started the first long table piece, gang piece. I don't know if you remember them.
I was in prison. See, I was in youth authority when Kaim Mustadi, Hawkins M, and Akili, the Steiner brothers, killed Bunchy Carter, right? Mm-hmm. And so they sent Kaim Mustadi to YTS. He was in YA with me. And when I came to San Quentin, the year I came to San Quentin, the Steiner brothers escaped from San Quentin. It was gone for 30, 40 years, you know? So I came up under the tutelage of Maulana Ron Karina, you know, after the Nation of Islam, it wasn't moving, wasn't rocking enough. So culture nationalism was an attraction to us at the time. You feel what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So when the long table and all of them came about, Bob Simmons and the stuff that they tried to do, they were cut off with the same thing with Jerry Hillman and Central City Brooks. The government displaced the whole organizations. You feel what I'm saying? And it became more economical for gang violence to improve instead of disseminate.
Yeah, you use it to justify police budgets and things of that nature. Like, when you were in incarcerated, you met a lot of people. But what were the issues with? Are you still there? Yeah. When you worked with I remember Suge Knight, and I know Reggie Wright and his family grew up in Imperial Courts. I mean, he used to coach over there and all that. And but at the same time, what role do you think police play in inciting or in any assassinations? You know, even at the Townsburger thing, I think when Suge caught that case for murder. I think, you know, you had to work with them and try to help them and things of nature. Tell us a little bit about those episodes, if you can.
It's nothing a coincidence, right? And for $147 million, people will do a lot of stuff. You feel what I'm saying? So it was one person that was at all times that were on all of these scenes when out of Compton, when Suge, because I was working with Tupac on a gridlock, me and Captain Shahid Muhammad, the Nation NOI Security had that movie set when Suge hired a Compton PD, took him off PD, the police department, and hired him as his head security, right? Mm-hmm. And that it changed the whole spectrum of how the mob and how Suge then moved, and it became out of his control. Now, when Tupac got killed in Las Vegas, the two people that contradicted everything that the other folks said happened mysteriously came up dead. You understand me? Frank Alexander and Michael Moore. The only other person, now we go over to when Biggie got killed. Now, all of a sudden, when Pac got killed, after Baby Lane got killed, everybody put the murder to Brenner and Ladd. They went and found a gun mysteriously after the man had said that was the murder weapon that killed. You had the murder weapon all the time, right? So now we go into the Biggie murder. Reggie was on the scene with the Biggie murder. Mm-hmm. Now Reggie was on the scene, as you know, that when Bunch Real got killed at the Shell station on Rosecrans and Atlantic, who was there on that scene, you know? So All of these things, and Suge, like nobody ever say that Suge kicked new. It's no charges filed against him in Las Vegas. But to get rid of him, they had to get rid of him. Man, the security is the next thing lowest on the totem pole to the janitor. So how do you go from security to running a whole record label? Mm-hmm. It's all economic. So the police involvement is heavy in most of this shit that go down, you know.
Mm-hmm. Because there was a lot of street discussion about what happened to Burrell, you know. And there's a lot of issues about, you know, just, you know, before crack took off, there was a lot of sherm houses in the city and prostitutional rings that they say law enforcement was heavily involved in. But at the same time, we had challenges on the street with the young people, and a lot of them are in foster homes now, and drugs seem to have had a profound effect on our people as far as the sherm and as far as crack. And it seemed to wreck families, not just the individual. I mean, families was turning families out. Cats was getting their women high, and it broke up a lot of families. Did you have any, you know, understanding of those challenges? With regards to the
family. I never could. I never dealt with crack, but it was a plague. Just like locust was a plague in biblical. See, it took the heart out of, it took a concept out of the soul of Black men and women. And for 30 years, kids didn't have nobody. And you have children, 13, 14 years old, selling crack to grown people, getting sexual favors from other homeboys' mothers, disrespectful. And you wonder how this generation is so disrespectful to older people. We left them nothing. These kids ain't been able to go in the park for 30 years. We're Black people, these old people. I remember at Omar's father's funeral, he was talking about Groucho, and they were talking about Reverend Fisher said, you know, don't worry about Groucho. He said he got all this. He said one day he made this little synopsis of, he said he came home one day and his wife told him to fire the gardener. And he says, fire the gardener? She said, that was a good gardener, but he didn't want to go against his wife. So he went to Pablo and told Pablo, man, I got to fire you. My wife said you messed up her prize roses. You cut her roses off. And he says that the gardener told him, Reverend Fisher, the roses had grown to their maximum and they were taking all the sun from the buds. And if they had to continue, the buds would not have been able to grow and bloom. We got all these old people in the city of Compton taking up all this air and you drowning out your children. You know, I remember when Omar took his fall, you know, and me, I had to sue the Compton Police Department for a failure to communicate, and they attacked me in the cell and said some Crips had jumped on me, right, in 1988. And I got a federal lawsuit against them. And one of the participants in it was Eric Parrott. And they demoted him from gang sergeant and had him back in a patrol car. When I went to prison, when I get out of prison, he was a deputy DA. Now, in the DA's department, and he said, if you have any charge against you under the color of authority, you cannot be a DA, or assistant DA, right? So Omar went and told, at the time, Cooney was the district attorney. He took my paperwork to Cooney and said, man, this dude here did this and this and that. And Cooney told him, how do I know the paperwork is authentic? And all you got to do is walk right across the street to the federal building. But he didn't want to acknowledge that. You feel what I'm saying? So when Omar got arrested, Mr. White, Mr. Howard, all the old men, 70, 80 years old, they was rallying, but none of them took the fall for Omar, right? So one day they called me, hey, Marvin, I got some feds that need to talk to you. And they want to talk. I said, what they want to talk to me about? Oh, that's tough with Eric Paradin. They want to talk to Eric about, man, they want to work do some stuff for Omar. So now these coons is trying to tell me to rat on another black. And because the white man said that they could get Omar out. And I told them this simply. And I'm not getting into that, but I'll tell you what you want to do. If you want to get rid of Eric Paradin, y'all ain't done nothing in your life. I'm in the law books. I done some shit. You dig what I'm saying? I'm known for something. I have created havoc. Y'all have been in Compton for 40, 50 years and nobody know you. Go up to the city council meeting one Tuesday when Eric Paradin comes, shoot him in the head and go down in the history book. Oh, you crazy. We ain't going to do that. So you don't want to give your life for it, huh? We want to protest. We want to march. We want to pray to Jesus, but we don't want to fight for ourselves, Professor Roth. Mm-hmm. And it says, if you stand for nothing, you'll fall for anything.
And I'm glad you raised the question about DAs, because I think there was a DA renting a house, a Malibu house from Suge down Death Row Records. And there was a DA that lost the shirt that allegedly Snoop was wearing in a drive-by killing. And so the DAs seem to have been compromised also from that standpoint. With regards to prosecution. And a lot of these cats seem that I've been able to spend big money. I remember Eric Paradin testified in Omar's election contest. When they raised the issue of him having a gun in a election poll, he said that he had a permit from Compton PD. But when the sheriff came in, they said Compton PD can't give gun permit, concealed weapons permit.
Right.
And you have to go through the guy, and there's no record. So he perjured himself at the trial. But the feds were there, you know, the DA was there, and they still didn't.
It's all right, because their prime, the prime goal was to get rid of you and Omar. We don't want no black men standing for Compton.
Yeah. Now, I want you to tell us a little bit about your podcast and a little bit about your history of doing personal security for celebrities and helping other people start their security companies, you and Big Cap.
Yeah, well, it's not an amazing story, but I tell people how blessing Shahid Muhammad is to me. You dig what I'm saying? I got out of prison in 1995, and I was working at Roscoe's Chicken and Waffle, making $5 an hour. Cap took me out for there and put me on the movie Set It Off. And I worked Set It Off with Queen Latifah. I was Jada Pickett's personal security. I left there. I did Rosewood with John Singleton. Then I left there. I did Eraser with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Vanessa Williams. Left that detail. I went and did Gridlock with Tupac. After we were taken off of that, he put me on an assignment working with Mike Tyson. I worked with Mike Tyson. Took me to Africa with him to the Rahman Hakim in South Africa. You know, the Concorde jet was $14,000. I told him I'll drive over there with $14,000. So I've been put on some blessed details. He put me up with Black Ground Record with Barry Hankerson. So I've been on some major details. I went to Israel with Bobby Brown and Whitney Houston, to the Wailing Wall when Bobby's sister had cancer, you know. So I've done a lot of, and I've done some bad security details, you know. I earned what I got, but Shahid was a great man in putting people together and making things where it was just the regular brothers could go in and deal with some amazing job sites. You know, I went from $5 an hour to $50 an hour. So those type of things. And, you know, we hooked up NOI security. Later on, you know, went into, right now I'm dealing with a podcast. I have a business called Potts Grove Farms, the Black Unicorn Factory. And we're a private IPO company that is private IPOs are startups, and it's a unicorn company. The word unicorn was coined in 2016. People don't know that President Barack, when people talk about what President Barack Obama did and didn't do, when Barack Obama took presidency, the nappy head niggas, coons and possums, the Bloods, the Crips, the Nation of Islam, the Christian Leadership Program should have told the CIA and the FBI, stand down, this is our boy. He had to work for 8 years under white scrutiny. And through that, he made it, making homes affordable. He did the Obamacare. And then he did something before he left office. He did a thing called the Jobs Act. And the Jobs Act, when Negroes hear jobs, we run from it. But it's jumpstart small businesses. And his jumpstarting small businesses, he was taking private IPO companies. We had a place called Black Wall Street. And Black Wall Street, in the determination of their community, they transferred their funds. It went 19 times through Black's hands before it got to whites. They had to burn Wall Street down. Then you had the Great Depression. After the Great Depression, the president made what you call the New Deal. What we know about the New Deal was Social Security, but he gave a shot in the arm to Wall Street and gave them $2 billion to bring back up Wall Street. 1933, they came up with the Security and Exchange Police, the SEC. Now, so Blacks couldn't be involved, they made it you had to be a millionaire or make $250,000 every year, or a millionaire had to introduce you to Wall Street in 1933. Well, we don't make $250,000 a year. I don't today in 2022. So it knocked all Blacks out of becoming major stockholders in Wall Street. What President Barack Obama did in 2014 when he made the Jobs Act and gave it to the Senate, when they he said, and go tell my people. His information was go tell black people, because he said he's going to level the playing field on economic misappropriation in blacks. So when white America made the Jobs Act in Chapter 7 in the Jobs Act, it doesn't say go tell blacks, it says go tell minorities, right? So being a minority don't make you black. Most of y'all just heard about the Jobs Act today, and it's been enacted since 2014. So you got all of these Asians, you got Armenians, all of them is private IPOs, and they came up with this thing called Unicorn. Unicorn stock is a private IPO stock that goes into the stock market, and they become a $1 billion company. Unicorn stock is the only stock that you get 1,000 times your investment. So with the Black Unicorn Factory, we don't use money for our funding rounds. We use people, because if you have $1 million and spend a dollar, you're not a millionaire no more. But if you have 1 million people, you can use those people any way you want, anyhow you need to use them. You feel what I'm saying? So our value is in our people. But our people are hard to believe. So we have a thing called Follow Me for Equity. If you can Potts Grove Farms or the Black Unicorn Factory, you can follow us. If you follow me, you get $150 worth of stock in my company. If you follow me for 1 year, faithfully, you'll make $180,000 worth of stock in my company. You can pull out in 14 months, you'll get $180,000. If you deal with me for 22 months, after I go into the open stock market in 18 months, your $180,000 become $1,800,000. So that's what we're into now, the Black Unicorn Factory. That's the new thing. That's what's coming up. And I deal with Potts Grove Farms. We started off with 16 companies. Now we have 82 companies. Right. So that's we're closing the wealth gap. When people are talking about, we got a credit card coming out called Dollar for Dollar Credit Card. Every dollar that you spend on the credit card, we put a dollar worth of stock in a company in the Black Unicorn Factory. So you're getting a dollar worth of stock every time you spend money out with our credit card. Mm.
So does it work like a debit card, or?
It's going to work like a debit card. Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. That's good. That's good. There's a lot of people I remember. I forget his name. His brothers, them were rappers. And he had his own credit card for a little while, debit card. I forget this brother.
Is that Run DMC, brother?
Yeah, his brother.
Everybody, you know, these people get Russell they Simmons, get debit right? cards.
That was Russell Simmons, correct?
Yeah, Russell.
Yeah, Russell Simmons. Yeah, Russell had one too. Mm-hmm. And they found a way to block Russell out, had him run, made him give up all his holdings, you know. So they always have a scheme some way until we have an intricate program where we work in-house and we can be independent instead of dependent, we'll always get shut out.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing, brother. It's an amazing struggle. It's always an amazing struggle for us as a people. So we have to continue to struggle. Now, brother Joe, do you have any more questions? Any comments?
Not really. I'm just sucking in this information. I had one question I want to ask him about. This is I don't know if you were in or out at the time, and I can't remember the years. It's been a couple of decades ago, I believe, where Latinos were just walking up shooting black people in gas stations and stuff like that. People coming home from work. Well, what's your assessment of what was going on at that time, if you were aware? And then also,
that was in the 80s, and when They green, the Mexican mafia had green lighted a ticket on blacks. They had threw down. This is when the Northern Familia, Mario Villa, the Mexican mafia, the 18th Street, all joined together for a hit on all blacks. I think it was behind. I think Huncho's brother killed a Mexican. I'm not sure. Huncho's brother got killed by a Mexican, and Huncho them had a Crip meeting up at Compton High School, and they were out on the football field of the high school, and the Mexican Compton Vario Thresi, T Flats Largos, and it came from in prison, and they start putting hits on all blacks. So in San Quentin, the first one that they killed was Lil Lou out of Grape Street Watts, and then they killed Lil Lou. Then they stabbed Ghost Willie Thomas out of Venice Shoreline, who had killed Sharon Berubikoff, taking a gold chain from her. And then June the 19th, they were down having a Juneteenth festival. All the Bloods and the BGF was locked up because the Mexican mafia teamed up with the Crips, the Blue Rags, and they had the Crips identify all Bloods, and had the Mexican mafia would identify all the BGF to the Crips. So it was like, man. So then when the Mexican mafia couldn't get at BGF or Bloods, they start killing Crips because they just killing blacks. We set tripping on who we kill. So they went to it. So it's been a loss cause since 1983, and we never got back from it. You know, we just keep losing. And, the Mexican population is, I'm not, you know, you can't be upset with people that you just gave your community to. We just handed it to them. You know, we didn't fight for anything. You know what I'm saying? They have been here all the time. And like people tell me, like, man, these Mexicans are taking over. Well, who do you think El Segundo is? Who do you think General Rosecrans is? Who do you think General Alameda is? Who is General Santa Fe? What black name is in Compton? It's Mexicans. You know what I'm saying? So they ain't taking nothing from us. You know what I'm saying? But I'd say the Mexicans, you got Santa Monica, you got Santa Ana, you got Whittier. Leave us with Compton at least. Where's a black town?
Yeah, I used to say that in my classroom. I said, you know, the name of these cities around here is not Zulu. You know, they doggone Latino. Dominguez, Santa Barbara, Los Angeles, you know, Pico Rivera, that's a Latino name. But I used to tell the Latinos that Spanish is not your native tongue. I say your people is Native American. You don't even know what Spain is on the map, and you talking about Spanish, right? Your native tongue. Right. What I call fried ice cream. But anyway, I want to say, you know, that I had coached Suge and Reggie Wright before I even came to Centennial. That
they were okay.
Mine, you know, and they used to interview me about Suge, about all this gangsterism. I like, Suge ain't no gangster. Where they got that from? When he was in Linwood, he had a duck tail down to the crack of his butt. I said, now what gangster you know wear a hairstyle like that? I don't know about him. But anyway, appreciate you, brother. And I hope to see you cross the path of Compton soon. Appreciate your presentation. Because I've been where I, you know, not to the extent that you were, but at Centennial, I tried.
But you know, the thing is, Brother Moore was talking about me coming to the school all the time about my son. And my son was a knucklehead. You feel what I'm saying? And all the men in Centennial tried to coach this guy, and he's had some of the best tutelage. He's been around the world. He had been in 30 states before he was 9 years old. He's had all the Professor Raw, everybody, Omar, he was sit on the lap of Minister Farrakhan, and he still want to be a knucklehead. But in that, kids that was around that just witnessed me. I see him every day. That got job, man, I used to see you up there with your son. Man, I used to wish I had a father like that. So a lot of the work you done don't come totally from you. It come from people around that see you. And that's the blessing, bro, because Lot couldn't find one.
Yeah, I, you know, I hear from them all the time. I be in Compton, drive down the street, somebody stop me. A lot of time I'm walking down Avalon when I do my walk and they'll pull over and holler at me, thank you for this and that. So anyway, and they invite me to a lot of their affairs. And one brother, Rolando, that's up there cutting hair at Just Showing Off right there, Rosecrans and, not Rosecrans, El Segundo and Avalon right there.
Right, right.
And me and him go fishing a lot. We go deep sea fishing all the time.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's worth it for us to save our children. It's worth it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so that's what I'm on. I'm man, if they kill me, I deserve to die. I'm in the street with them every day, you know, and you don't call me this. You respect me as a grown man. I'm not your friend. I'm not your homeboy. I'm the dude that's going to look out when nobody else is looking out.
Right.
So that's our job. We can't be scared of our own children.
Oh, no, I go up to any one of them's house, and they all knew that.
Yeah.
To your door, you know.
We appreciate that. Brother Machenda, do you have any more comments?
No, no more comments. Again, thank you for the presentation, brother. Keep doing it.
All right. Brother Rossetti?
Hey, I appreciate Brother Alitola, man. I'm on your team, brother.
For sure.
That's for sure.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
Yeah.
I just want to close by saying I attended one of the most eye-opening activities that I ever attended, and that was the rites of passage that Ayatollah put on for his son. We was off of Stanford at that church, and you had decorated the whole church, and you had me and Omar speak. But for a person to put on a rite of passage for their son, that's putting into practice the teaching, the history of cultural development and consciousness. And I told him, come from a lineage. His mother was an activist. His mother was one of the Elm Street. You should have heard the testimony at her transition ceremony. All the brothers that talked about her and Elm Street and how she kept it together. So he came from a strong lineage of activism. But above all, me and him was, you know, he's been to my house. I can't count the times. And we share each other's families. My wife and you know, she always asked about Ayatollah. Have you talked to Ayatollah? I get on the phone and say, hey, brother, how you doing? He say, what's up? I say, man, I'm just checking on you. You know, and that's what we do to each other. And we share the spiritual immortality of a brother, Captain Big Cap Shahid.
That's right.
Rashiki knew Big Cap. He was at the transition service.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, it's just monumental how I was a professor. We grew up together. I went on to become a professor. But I learned more from Shahid than any class I took to get the degrees I got. He taught me all about Islam.
That's right.
And to this day, Brother Ayatollah, Brother Abdullah, they still open up in Juma in prayer every morning and when they can at 12 noon on Fridays. No matter where you are, you stop. Shahid taught me how to do the Islamic prayer.
That's right.
But above all, we drill. We drill.
That's right.
And when I say drill, Big Cap with drill. Now, I'm not talking about marching, doing FYI steps. I'm talking about the art of self-defense and the
That's
art
right.
the art of conscious warfare. We had a beautiful experience, and I told her, open my eyes to what brotherhood is really about. This brother, sincere. Anytime I gotta get into any issue, this one first brother I'll call, because I know he knows how to get down, but he also knows how to tell me, no, check yourself or you wreck yourself. You understand? You know, you don't just run out there. So I just want to say a side thing to you, Brother Marvin. When I asked him to get on the show, it was no hesitation. And Rasha Kiyad wanted to get him on. And I want to know, you have a standing invitation. But before you leave, tell us how we can get to your podcast and any other programs you got coming up that we can put on our event calendar, Rasha Kiyad, to let the people know, because you speak all over the country to penitentiary groups as well as street gangs. They bring you in to try to develop a peaceful transition of young men. So is there any announcements you have or anything you want to say before we close out?
No, right now, I'm going to get back with you. We'll start our podcast August the 4th on on our national podcast. But you can find us on blackunicornfactory.com and get the information and follow us, and you know, let's build this, let's break this transition of being broken and close the wealth gap with people. You know, we got 45 million black people in America. Let's at least 20 million of us get together.
Okay. All right. Brother Rasha Kiyad, you want to make an announcement for Wednesday? Can you hear me?
Got Sister Make. Can you hear me? Can you hear me, Ross?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, so make it happen on, and she's asking the question, but we're gonna talk about, well, the title is Who is Colonel Bird? So we're gonna discuss Colonel Allen.
You keep breaking up, so we'll put it on the announcement. Again, brother Otto, you know you're welcome. And if anytime you need, this will be on YouTube.
Yes, sir.
And the people, and so if you want to direct somebody to it, just Community Education Network is also be on our website, the audio. So if yes, you sir. Want somebody to hear your presentation, your son or anybody else, you can direct them to that. Also, YouTube on the Community Education Network, and we put that together. But again, you know you have a standing invitation.
Thank you so much.
If you want to get back on, if there's any meetings or programs you want to discuss with the community, Brother Mashinda, Brother Hembrick, and Brother Rasha Kiyad. We had a brother called a good doctor, but he'll be back on a little later. But we want to thank you, man. As we always say, the grains of sand are few on the ocean floor in comparison to the many thanks that we give you for being on our podcast in celebration of our year completion as the Conscious Corner. And we want to thank you. You were our headline guest, and we give it. Do you want to say something?
You're
still breaking up a little, but go ahead, try.
Yeah, we got Sister Making It Happen. Sister Make It Happen on Wednesday, and she's asking the question, who is Colonel Allen's work? So we're gonna discuss Colonel Allen's work.
Okay. Allen's work.
Yeah.
I already know. I got t-shirts on it. Talking about Colonel Allen.
Okay, wonderful.
Yeah, he was a colonel.
That's what we're gonna discuss.
Okay then. All right, so again, thank you again, Brother Otto, and you just keep on pushing, keep on doing what you're doing. You're doing a lot of good, bringing good into the world. and doing good into the world. So we deeply appreciate
it. Sante.
All right, over and out, everybody.
All right.
All right. Peace.